Hawaii's reef fish are being overfished. That's the conclusion of the largest study of its kind ever undertaken. It included information compiled by researchers and multiple government agencies going back to the year 2000, and it made use of more than 25,000 in-water surveys. Alan Friedlander is the lead author of the study. He's a chief scientist for National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project and director of the Fisheries Ecology Research Lab at the University of Hawaii. He spoke with HPR News Director Bill Dorman in October when the study was published.
What do you think is the most important finding out of this study?
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill. Yeah, I think over the course of the study, what we found is there is a good news and bad news story. There are places within the main Hawaiian Islands, particularly around the populated areas, that have suffered significantly from overfishing, as well as other things like pollution and coastal development, primarily around Oahu and parts of Maui. But there's also places around the state that look amazing, remote areas like Niihau, Ko'olawe, North Shore Molokai, Hamakua Coast. So these areas look more like the northwestern Hawaiian Islands than they do the main Hawaiian Islands. So I think there's hope for a lot of the reefs in the middle there, so we can learn lessons from what has worked elsewhere and what hasn't worked.
Speaking of learning lessons, you compared fish density across the islands by moku, which is a traditional Hawaiian resource management tool. Can you explain that a bit more?
Sure. So aupua'a, or watersheds, were nested within moku, and moku represent basic biophysical properties, windward areas, leeward, north shore, south shore. So they made a lot of sense from a biological standpoint, and the Hawaiians recognized that. And they managed things holistically from Makua to Makai, and everything was integrated. And so when we put this whole study together, we thought that the best thing to do would be to learn from the past. And so we recognized that they managed at a more of a decentralized level, more at the moku level or even the aupua'a level. Hmm. So we tried to have the biology reflect that.
So in terms of where we go from here, are there further lessons in terms of traditional Hawaiian cultural practices that could come into play here and management of fisheries?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can learn a lot from the past. The Hawaiians manage their resources quite effectively with fairly large populations in the past. Think pono practices, things like taking only what you need. But most important was probably recognizing spawning cycles. The Hawaiian moon calendar was used to most effectively manage when to fish, but more importantly, when not to fish. It's kind of the opposite of what we think about today as far as recognizing fishing practices. You know, we want to know when they knew when to lay off of fish, when they were spawning, when they were most susceptible. If you give fish a chance to spawn, they get to be big enough to spawn during the right times of year, you're going to have fish in the future.
Now, in order to sort of carry that forward, you're going to need buy-in from a lot of folks. Do you see that coming? I'm thinking of the commercial fishery side of life.
It's a complicated issue in the nearshore fisheries. Actually, the commercial fisheries only represent about 10% of the nearshore catch. It's primarily recreational users, cultural subsistence users. Everyone is part of the problem, so therefore everyone needs to be part of the solution.
And you had said that the study itself is really a first step to get the discussion going. So what kind of form does that discussion take, and who's involved in it?
There's already really good efforts afoot throughout the state at the community level. There's communities like in Haena on the north shore of Kauai that was the first legally designated community-based fisheries management area in the state. So applaud their efforts and the state's efforts for allowing that to move forward. There's other communities on Molokai, Momomi, on Hawaii Island. Kapolehu just has established a 10-year tri-wait period where they're going to, let the area replenish itself and areas in Mo'olii. So there's communities out there that are trying to reestablish control over the area and try to decentralize it. And that's one great step in that direction. But it's going to be multiple steps. More conventional marine life conservation districts need to be established. The last one established was in 2003, so it's been a while. But people are just going to have to think about their overall footprint and how we can minimize that so that there's fish for the future.
You know, one of the interesting things about the study was you produced a very visual map showing fish density around the islands, and it seemed to track population. You know, the greater the human population, the less dense the fish population, which on a basic level seems to make sense. But what, again, in terms of moving ahead and taking action with this study, where does that lead you to?
So, yeah, there's a very clear correlation, more people, less fish, and vice versa. So we need to recognize where there's a lot of people, we need to have fairly concerted efforts and maybe, you know, think about pretty robust ways that we can manage these resources. In places where the human population density is still modest, those are the places that we should focus energies, because those reefs are healthy. Those reefs are still providing access to people. They're providing all the services that people want, you know, food, culture. It's all about, you know, lifestyle. So there's ways to do that, but it's on that continuum that we need to think about where we can most effectively manage. Not one size fits all. It's going to be a different solution for different problems. The state's complex. It took us a long time to get to where we are today, so there's not going to be one solution to this. It's going to be a multitude of solutions.
You know, the logistics also, again, it's very impressive just in terms of the study itself. Again, it's in a peer-reviewed journal, but it goes back, your information goes back nearly two decades, and tens of thousands of surveys in the water. How were you able to gather all this, and from various sources?
Yeah, so I myself spent a lot of time in the water and have been fortunate to see almost every reef from South Point up to Kure Atoll and
wow.
Everywhere in between. But this was a collective effort between Nature Conservancy, the State of Hawaii, Division of Aquatic Resources, NOAA, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And so we all got together and realized this bounty of data that we had. It's unprecedented at a global scale. For one particular location, there's never been this much data that existed. And then putting it all together was a job for one of my grad students who spent over a year, Mary Donovan, working on this. And, you know, to calibrate all this, because there's different methods that were used, different locations. So she really spent a lot of time calibrating all this. And it's really the most robust data that exists for any single location. So we're very confident in our findings.
Are there any other areas, just because the whole idea of reef health is so critical for Hawaii, are there other areas that this research can be applied to, or is this pretty much just the reef fishing at this point?
I think this can be applied across the board. I mean, it's lowering our footprint, whether mm-hmm. it's using sustainable fishing practices or thinking about the footprints that we leave in along the coastal zone, but even in the upland area, I think is applicable to places outside of Hawaii. And again, you know, in Hawaii, each island has different needs and wants and community composition. But at the end of the day, 99% of the state of Hawaii is water. And so we all rely on a healthy ocean. At the World Conservation Congress last year, Governor Ige announced this 30 by 30 initiative to sustainably protect 30% of Hawaii's resources by 2030. And that was an announcement made on the world stage, very bold announcement. I think now is a time and a call to action to do something. We know what some of the problems are, and we need to move ahead with the solutions now.
And Alan, I get a feeling that we're going to be talking to you again as we move ahead with this.
I look forward to it. It's going to take a lot of people to, you know, work our way. But at the end of the day, a healthy ocean is going to be the best thing for all of us.
That was Alan Friedlander, Chief Scientist for National Geographic Pristine Seas Project and Director of the Fisheries Ecology Research Lab at the University of Hawaii. He spoke to HBR's News Director Bill Dorman in October about his longitudinal study of fish density around the Hawaiian Islands. You can find a link to that study on today's edition of the Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, this is Dave Lawrence. We've heard from generals, grandmothers, craftsmen in their workshops, teachers in their classrooms, all saying HPR is the soundtrack of my daily life. Our support base is growing, but we need it to be larger still to sustain our work in the future. Your gift could count towards your 2017 tax deduction, but you don't have much more time. Please become a sustaining member or donate any amount today through our mobile app. And thanks.
Season's greetings and Happy New Year. This is Kimmy Bomolero. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Today, we're looking back at some of the highlights of 2017. In September, Chris Vandercook sat down with author Jamal Yogis, a man on a spiritual quest, stimulated in part by his surfing days in Hawaii. Jamal relived his days as a teenage seeker and soul surfer in his first memoir, Saltwater Buddha. His search widens and takes him afar in his follow-up memoir, All Our Waves Are Water. We caught up with him in the middle of his book tour, and he shared his unique perspective about his relationship with the ocean.
Whether you're doing it for a living or because you just love to play around, I think the ocean feeds us. It makes us peaceful. It brings, even the neuroscience shows that just when you get in the water and float, you get out of sort of prefrontal cortex planning mode, and there's a more distributed set of points. I mean, this is assuming the ocean doesn't make you afraid, but if you're a person who likes the water, you instantly go into a more sort of hyper-present mode, and that's healing for us.
It demands, the ocean demands that you understand your presence in it as being in the presence of a power infinitely more powerful than yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons mystics and philosophers have drawn on the ocean for teachings. You know, in the Zen tradition, they compare the individual self to a wave on the ocean and the Buddha nature as the ocean itself. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, says, you know, we're not a drop in the ocean, we're the entire ocean in a drop. And so there's all these great metaphors to draw on. But then also when you're actually in the ocean, it's so dynamic, you can't fall asleep. You know, I make a lot of connections between sitting meditation and surfing. And one of the things that I think, if you're a surfer and you meditate, you can benefit from your surfing experience, because when you're on your cushion, you can fall asleep, you can zone out, but when you're out there in the ocean, you can't. You need to stay alert. And so, again, there's a sort of hyper-presence that the sea invokes.
Did you become aware of that early in your life?
I always loved the ocean. My dad was a surfer. We lived in the Azores, Portugal, when I was about 3 to 6, and we were out there body surfing every day, and the beach was just a wonderful place to be. It wasn't probably until I had more frightening experiences when I was really learning to surf in Hawaii, you know, got my face grated on the reef when I was out on the Big Island, where I realized, wow, you know, you can't zone out for a minute here. And that's essential. You can bring that on to land, you know. And the water makes you naturally more aware. I think it's one of the reasons it's so healing for autistic children and people with sensory integration. Having all that pressure of the water on all your nerves makes you less sort of in your head. A lot of times we're just telling infinite stories about things that might happen or things that happened in the past, and we're not really living now and aware of what's going on. We're sort of naturally like walking around with a cell phone, but the cell phone's in our head. And now we actually have the cell phone too. And so in the water, you can't bring your cell phone, which is great, but then you also can't be spinning out in infinite stories. And so, you know, I continue to learn that every day.
Spinning out, that's an interesting phrase, spinning out in infinite stories, because, you know, anyone who goes on a spiritual quest, tries to learn to meditate, finds that, you know, your head is full of noise. If I try to quiet my mind down, I just can't believe all the stuff that's flying around in there.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, it's one of the first things you learn when you sit and meditate. Everybody thinks they're a terrible meditator because they think they're supposed to have this instant experience of, oh, now I'm not thinking.
The void, yeah.
That's a myth. And
good.
The idea is really to take an observer's perspective of the mind, and that's one of the amazing things about the mind is that the mind can distance itself from itself.
Yeah.
And so in meditation, you take the perspective of watching your thoughts much like you might watch waves on the ocean, so you don't identify with them so much, because so much of our suffering comes from identifying with those waves. We have a wave of jealousy or a wave of
attachment.
Of attachment or fear. And that spins out more stories. We say, oh, I'm always jealous, or I'm, you know, my parents screwed me up, or, mm-hmm.
I can't control this or that craving.
Exactly. And so the storytelling and really the resistance to those waves is often creates more suffering than just the wave itself. And that's part of the theme of this book, All Our Waves Are Water, is to see that, well, are those big wave emotional waves of fear or jealousy or anger so bad in and of themselves if you don't attach a story to them, or can you just let them pass by, much like a stormy day mm-hmm. at the ocean can be beautiful if you just kind of say, oh, well, it is. You know, that is a part of life.
Attach a story to them as in dragging your own story into it?
Dragging your own story into it, and the key piece is attaching an identity story to it, because our minds are wild. This is the biology we're saddled with, where we have an unconscious and a conscious mind, and things are going at a rapid fire pace. And that isn't necessarily, there isn't a self in there that's navigating those. They're just, when you sit down in silence and you watch, there's old memories of TV shows and big emotions and planning, and those are happening nonstop, not by your own force of will. And so a lot of our emotions that we experience come from attaching an identity story to those. So if you sit for or spend some time in nature where you can quiet the mind and you're not having infinite inputs, mm-hmm. you can actually, one, the waves start to find space, so you have a little bit more peace of mind. And two, you can start to see how these emotions and these emotional stories that we identify with aren't necessarily true. They're not facts. Mm-hmm. They are just sort of phenomena that the mind is churning out. And so as a meditator, you can kind of decide, I'm going to let this wave go because it's not useful to me, and B, it's not really true, mm-hmm. With a capital T. Or, hey, this is a great joyful wave. You know, I'm in love with my newborn child, and I'm going to ride it. And then you're kind of surfing that ride, and that's an enjoyable part of being a human. But when you start to meditate, you can start to choose. Do I want to ride this wave, or I don't want to let it go?
It sounds like absent meditation, we just sort of attach ourselves to everything, every wave that comes flowing through.
We do. We're just heedless if we don't have at least some way of anchoring ourselves in the present and being able to take a perspective on our own minds. And a good portion of the world is walking around heedless like that and out of control of their own emotions. And, so it's a key thing to learn. I think kids should learn it from a young age.
Well, it's very easy to feel as if you are the captive of your mind, rather than the captor, in a sense, yeah? That it's going to go, it's going to take you know not where, and you might not like it very much.
Well, you are, and most of what you're feeling is on top of that, run by your unconscious, which is, you know, the lizard brain is churning out all these desires about survival and sex and anger, et cetera. And if you don't have just a little handle on that, that's going to run you rather than you being able to say, well, you know, actually that's not going to help me if I go get angry at my 3-year-old or something.
I think there are probably a lot of people who are hearing this and identifying with all or part of it. Thanks very much, Jamal.
Thank you.
Jamal Yogis is the author of All Our Waves Are Water, a HarperCollins memoir that the BBC called the best beach read of 2017. He was in Hawaii for a book tour last September and spoke with our Chris Vandercook. You can listen back to his interview on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Time now for our reality check. Did Hawaii officials really try to quash a CNN report on homelessness? That's a fair question to ask. Joining me for today's reality check is Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair. Morning, Chad.
Hello, Catherine.
So quite a story.
You know, what caught our headline, excuse me, the headline that caught our eye, rather, was, I'm just going to read it to you. This is on Hawaii News Now about a week ago. Waianae homeless leaders say the state blocked a CNN story about their camp. And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. And what the reporter, JoBeth DeVera, reported was not necessarily inaccurate. In fact, the Department of Land and Natural Resources was not crazy about allowing a film crew from CNN to go out there to Waianae. And you know about this camp. It's run by Twinkle Borge. Right. It's quite a story. Some say it's a model for safe zones and for people taking care of themselves. Others say, wait a minute, this is not really solving the problem of homelessness. And by the way, this is state land. So sure, the DLNR was not crazy and about having this. They denied CNN the permit to go and film. Well, guess what? CNN went out there anyway and did film the interview, and it's going to air sometime in April and May. But it brings to question things that you and I deal with all the time, right? The media, government relations, what to control, what to get out. And I'm sure with your TV background, you can relate to, hey, is that a good story? No question. It sure looks like a good story. Here's the state not wanting a story to get out.
Right. And at the same time, you know, you can also look at DLNR's mission, and their mission is to protect the resource. And one point is, okay, they may not like the homeless camp out there because it might threaten the shrimp ponds that are in that area that are a valuable resource.
Absolutely. And that's something the Hawaii News Now reporter did, in fact, include. Not only that, there's also Evie out there, something that didn't make it into the TV report, but something that DLNR did say. We need to be careful about protecting these ancestral remains. You don't want people just stomping around out there. DLNR also didn't want to give the incorrect perception that somehow the state sanctifies this use of, I remember, this is the Waianae Boat Harbor, where the camp is located. And they didn't want to give the wrong impression. As you know, homelessness is a very serious problem here, and the headlines have not been good. On the other hand, this is not a new story. It's already been picked up here locally. It's been picked up by The Guardian and Business Insider nationally, internationally. I can say that what Hawaii News Now is saying, Twinkle, the head of the Waianae camp, wanted to share the story with a wider audience to show that, look, we can take care of this problem. We are living well and taking care of our people out here in Waianae.
And you and I have been around long enough. We recall the situation with the homeless camps out over by Yokohama Bay and the PR disaster they had when they had, you know, pictures and video of folks hauling the homeless out of the shoreline there. So I'm pretty sure they're sensitive about that.
Absolutely. And the folks at the Waianae camp have that very much in mind. There is no certainty that they're going to be able to stay there forever. In fact, at some point you wonder whether the state is going to move them. That has been the trend from Kaka'ako to Kapalama Canal to under Nimitz. I mean, that is the pattern, is to move them elsewhere. But then where do they go? Do they come back? Is this really solving the problem of homelessness?
Right.
I think that's why the discussion of safe zones are so important, something we're going to be talking about at the legislature next session.
Right. Thank you. That was Civil Beat's political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check. On this final workday of 2017, we check in with Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, here to fill us in on next week's stories. You've got some business perspectives?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, starting off with a couple of different viewpoints on the business front heading into the new year next week. Wrapping up 2017, it's been a strong year for the U.S. stock market. Everybody pretty much knows that, realizes that. By some measures, it's the best since 2013. But beyond the United States sort of gets a little less attention. So looking around the neighborhood, the Asia-Pacific neighborhood, in terms of some of the stock markets, some of the major markets there, looking at how the year has been and how the year is setting up for 2018, part of this is stock market is not the economy, but it's part of the economy, and it's part of an economic indicator. And so the economic health of a lot of these local regional economies is very important to Hawaii. Of course, the tourism industry is the major focus on that. And when you see the visitor counts, Japan, Australia, South Korea, certainly a big impact on that. But it's also more broadly indicates sort of global economic health as well in terms of Asia-Pacific and its role in the global economy. So a little chance to sort of look back, look ahead a little bit.
Do you have any local ties to those issues?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of those come through people, a lot of the market more broadly, although, as I say, and as Kai Rizdal is always saying on Marketplace, you know, the economy is not the stock market, but the stock market gives a sense, it's one indicator. So even locally, in terms of widely held stocks, for example, of local companies here, publicly held companies here, how's the year been? We did a little bit today, and we spoke the other day in terms of local banks, but beyond the banks, how are we doing? How are we looking? How has 2017 been, and again, into the new year?
And we hear you've got something in the works about a local printmaker with a different approach?
Yeah. So Charles Cohen, local printmaker, you could call him old school, definitely, handmade, woodblock prints with hand tools on metal and wood. He's the chair of printmaking department at UH Art Department, current exhibit at Honolulu Museum of Art. Noe Tanigawa knows a thing or two about this, says he's one of the strongest and least appreciated artists here. She'll have a lot more on that next week.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
You bet.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-working.
Back in June, we met apprentice navigator Jenna Ishii, who has sailed on many of the legs of the Hokulea voyages to the Galapagos, to Australia, Nova Scotia, and many more. As education coordinator at the Pacific Voyaging Society, she's arranged many of the connections between groups and individuals that happened at each landfall during the Malama Honua worldwide voyage. Noe Tanigawa asked Jenna to sketch out how the ambitious idea came about.
The idea was born in 1992 with our astronaut, Lacey Veach. Lacey was from Hawaii. He flew Space Shuttle Columbia. And in 1992, looking over the Hawaiian Islands, when he came back, he told Nainoa's father, take Hokulea around the world, you know, see what you can learn from the earth and bring it back to Hawaii. And those gifts from Hawaii can be gifts back to the earth. And that was basically the whole genesis of the idea of taking Hokulea around the world. This planet is in trouble and it needs help, and see what we can do. But it wasn't until 2007 when our leadership came to Japan and saw that people from all walks of life that did not speak English were coming in hundreds to touch Hokulea. And they said, you know, maybe it's time. Maybe Hokulea can do something, because she stands for peace and she stands for aloha. And in 2008, they agreed again. All of our voyaging leaders said, we're going to do this. And actually, that's when I came home to Hawaii and started volunteering with Polynesian Voyaging Society. So I was lucky to be part of the initial planning stages of, are we crazy? Really? Should we do this?
That did occur to you then.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, some people were worried. Why are you taking Hokulea from our kids in Hawaii? What if something happens to her? She's the only Hokulea we have.
But that's when you, Jenna Ishii, began your training as an apprentice navigator. What skills does non-instrument navigation require?
You know, when you think about it, Polynesia is the biggest nation on Earth. They were the greatest scientists and explorers and mathematicians on the planet at their time. And so when you start breaking it down and you're like, wow, I'm doing math, I'm doing physics, I'm doing astronomy, you need every single part of this world of the modern day sciences and the ancient ways of looking at nature to find your way. And I know he says you make about 1,000 observations a day and you make 2 decisions a day at sunrise and sunset, how far you think you've gone, where you've come from, and where you're going.
Mm-hmm. You've kind of put us on the boat there for just a second. I wish I could look into your eyes and see what you've seen.
You know, it's been amazing that folks like Nainoa and Bruce and Onohi, Shorty, Kalepa, they stay with us and they'll voyage with us. Nainoa says, I can teach you everything, you know, with a book. I can give you all the materials that we learned these last 40 years, but it's not till you're on the deck of the canoe watching me, watching how I stand, watching how I sleep, that you'll really understand what it's like to navigate. We're not scared. We're excited and ready for the next challenge. And they're always there, you know, if we have questions and so forth.
Well, how do you stand?
You know, imagine that you have no stars in the sky and it's complete cloud cover. So if you stand with your 2 feet firmly, you know, on the canoe, yeah. So anywhere on the canoe, but looking forward, you can start feeling the motion of how the 2 hulls are moving through the ocean and how the wind is coming across the canoe and how the swells are moving through the canoe. And the best navigators like Papa Mao, they could be sleeping in a hull and know where they were going by the motion of the canoe.
By reading the currents and swells through their body.
What you do is when you have a cue like the sun or the moon or a star, you know exactly where that is, and you can kind of place it. We call it a Hawaiian star compass. It's this mental construct of 32 points around the canoe, and you place whatever you know for sure, and then you kind of set your course for the day. And if all the cues in the sky go away, hopefully you can keep that course with the predominant swell and wind direction.
What if those change?
They do, and they change all the time. So if you have no more cues left and you don't feel confident anymore, you can close your sails and wait for a sign. And that's a good lesson in life, that you don't always have all the answers, and sometimes you have to just stop and wait, and nature will give you a sign. You just have to be patient.
I understand you don't get much sleep.
Yeah, usually, I mean, if you look at folks like Nainoa, he'll only sleep for like 2 hours a day max. You know, he'll take cat naps. So we try and mimic that. It's really hard.
Oh,
you get really delirious. And I've been seasick. I had a migraine. I think I had heat exhaustion. And I was trying to navigate in Samoa. And you just have to pull yourself together. But there are those moments where it just takes you to your deepest part of yourself where you have to kind of pull through. But I love that. I love that moment, actually. It's when you feel most alive.
It's good you feel that way, Jenna. But even, you know, people saying, okay, we'll hold this for 4 hours with really, how are they judging where they are?
Right. Well, the hardest time to navigate is the middle of the day. I mean, really from about 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. or even 3 p.m., the sun can't tell you much of anything. And so the crew members are actually, sometimes they're steering backwards. They're looking at the swell coming through the canoe. They're looking at the wind coming off the canoe. And those are really the cues they're using. Sometimes you can hold a distant cloud for maybe 15 minutes. So I know it teaches us some tricks. The system that was created is that you kind of look, you can base, it's like a really cool math problem. So you look at a wall and you stand a certain couple steps back and you measure the degrees 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to about 20, and you put your hand out. So if you see the film Moana and she's putting her hand out, she's actually measuring the degrees from the horizon to whatever you have, a rising star, what that degree is. And so we, ahead of time, everyone calibrates their hands. And each degree is 4 minutes. So every time the star rises, 1 degree, 2 degree, 3 degrees, that's 4 minutes later, 8 minutes later, and so on. So you can tell time using your hands. That's how we keep track of when people switch their watches. We measure the stars traveling, but that's how we use our hands.
You know, we didn't talk at all about the summit.
Yeah, you want people to go to that, right?
Yeah, so this whole week of homecoming is about celebrating. On Saturday, coming to Magic Island, everyone's welcome. And what we decided is to have this summit for the community on Sunday, Monday, and some parts of Tuesday at the Convention Center. Hokulea is coming under the bridge of the Alawai Canal. She'll be right there at the bottom of the stairs for canoe tours every day from 10 to 5. It's open to the public. There will be about 100 or so exhibitors of all our people from around the world in Hawaii that are doing things to take care of the earth. There'll be keiki activities. Sunday is a youth summit for kids ages 5 to 25. And Monday is the inspirational speaker series. And we invited some of our great navigators around the world that we've met. So that's going to be an awesome day. So, yeah, we invite you to come down Sunday, Monday, Tuesday and check us out. Hokulea.com is where you can find all the information.
That homecoming was fabulous. Hokulea arrived on June 17th this summer. Welcome home with ceremonies and day-long events at Magic Island. HPR's Noe Tanigawa spoke with Jenna Ishii, apprentice navigator and education coordinator with the Polynesian Voyaging Society. The group has been hosting the Mahalo Hawaii Sail. The canoe and its crew is stopping around the island to thank the community statewide for its support. And during the port visits, PVS will host canoe tours and connect with local schools and community groups. That Mahalo Sail will continue through 2018.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
One of the musical highlights this year was when Hawaiian Style Band founding members Brian Kessler and Wade Camburn, along with Roby Kahakalau, joined Chris Vandercook to perform and talk about their debut album, Vanishing Treasures, released 25 years ago. Contemporary Hawaiian music had come of age and was well on its way to incorporating styles from far distant music genres, reflecting a new sensibility in both sound and subject matter. Chris asked about the ideas that fueled their success.
It was just in the beginning stages, I think. We had Brother Walta that was sort of doing a reggae-ish kind of a Jawaian.
Right.
And I started calling it Jewaian because, you know, obvious reasons. But that was all that was really happening, and that was huge music. And,
yeah.
And that sort of ushered in the change a little bit, which was real different than the C&K Kalapana kind of a sound years before. And we basically started developing that sound from a couple of commercials that we were working on at the time, Hawaiian Style Clothing and Local Motion Clothing. And we had this commercial that was just all over the airwaves called A Na Na Local Motion that people were calling up and going, what is that? We want to buy that record. Where can we get it? It's a commercial. And that's kind of, we kind of went with that. And I remember getting together with Bla Pahanui. He helped us a little bit on that first album. He said, you know what? That beat is really something.
Yeah.
You should really write some more songs around that beat. And I think that kind of resonated with both Wade and I.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that piece we heard just before we started talking, where the way the drum was mixed into that. There's a big boom on the tom-tom.
Yes.
That wouldn't have been part of Hawaiian music maybe a decade earlier.
Absolutely not. Those early tunes were drum loops and drum machines before we added the live guys to copy what we had done with the drum loops. Yeah.
I think it's also interesting to note that you know, both Brian and I had been playing around town quite a bit in top 40 groups.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, both Paul Simon, his Graceland album, and Sting were popular. Mm-hmm. And we very much allowed those sounds, those songs, to influence what we were doing with contemporary Hawaiian music. We would use a Hawaiian song and give it a different beat and arrangement, too. Mm-hmm. We used a lot of arrangement protocols that came up in these songs by these other artists.
That's a good point, Wade, because that really is, you know, Paul Simon went to Africa, recorded his album with all the local guys there. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a thing worldwide in music of people opening their ears to, you know, sounds from continents away, as opposed to sticking to this is what you're supposed to do in instrumentation, rhythm, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Case in point, our song Living in a Sovereign Land, when the guitar part comes in the middle of that, it's right out of the Graceland album. It's that mm-hmm. African kind of guitar part that's mm-hmm. mixed with the lopey kind of groove with the slack key-ish guitars all kind of mixed in there. You know, and that created that sort of more worldish kind of a feeling, you know.
Well, you know, I think back to the days when you'd go in the record store and there'd be these compartments, right? Each one labeled with, you know, with this is jazz, this is blues, this is country, and, you know, let not the twain ever meet.
Right?
It was, It was everyone in his ghetto kind of thing.
But yeah.
That kind of broke down, didn't it, Wade? In those years, right around the time you guys were getting started.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, like Brian said, we incorporated some new sounds. We also got some recognition from a guy named Robbie Burns, who put together Locomotion Clothing Company. He kind of recognized that there was an opening here, and he came up with the name Hawaiian Style Band, and I wrote Live a Little Hawaiian Style, and that was really our starting point mm-hmm. for all of this. And we won the Hoku for the single of the year in, I think it was 1990? Yeah. 91 was the awards, mm-hmm. and it was for the year of 1990. And after that experience, you know, we all just kind of looked at each other and said, let's do a whole album.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to more of what we were already doing. And you mentioned Sovereign Land because I think for I know I speak for myself that I learned a lot about local issues and Hawaiian issues that were going on. So it was a learning experience for me at the time. I enrolled at KCC and took a language course. And, you know, I really wanted to jump into even the Hawaiian culture, even though I'd been here for several years already. I really listened, you know, to a lot more music at that point, Hawaiian music.
And, you know, and you guys, of course, brought in musical skills from other genres as well, which was clearly going to influence how the music.
Yes, we were the two Hali guys, you know. From people knew our music before they knew what we looked like.
Right.
You know, and it was incredible.
Which is probably just as well.
Yeah, right. We do these concerts and they go, you were the guys that did all that? Because we had some great guest artists with us on the first album.
Yeah.
We had Brother Iz and Del Beasley and Teresa Bright. Mm-hmm. And they were playing all those songs on the radio. And it was all the same group, but all those songs were being played. So when we finally got out there and started performing, it was a real eye-opener for us as well as the people who were watching us.
Certain amount of disbelief.
Yeah.
But, you know, even with the, you know, sort of innovative approach to accepting other influences in terms of what you were saying in your lyrics, there was lots of let's return to local style. That had a very traditional bent to it. There's a real appreciation of local life. And that's kind of a look back to the good old days.
Yes, absolutely.
I did take the opportunity, too, to, in my writing, I developed kind of a snapshot mm-hmm. of local life. You know, what I saw, what I observed, what I learned, I tried to put to song. You know, with the exception of maybe a love song like Love and Honesty, that did bring in some local elements, imagery, and so forth. There's a lot to write about here in Hawaii.
Well, you've proven that ever since, and we're going to hear your music now with Roby Kahakalau joining them. Okay. What have you got for us?
Well, we're going to do a song called Old Style Way. One, two, three. Mm-hmm.
barefoot boy. They're born and raised singing songs the old style way. In the old style way, life was so sweet. It didn't take a lot of money just to make ends meet. With the love of a girl and a little bit of faith, there's a lot you can say for the old style way.
As he works the land,
works the land,
sows the seed,
sows the seed
that grows into,
grows into
his
destiny. Away. Life was so simple then, unlike today, in a world gone mad, where eyes warm and bright turn cold and gray. Still I can dream in the old style way, by the light of the moon. Comes to watch him play as he sings to her the story of the love. The night ends too soon. He wishes she would stay as his eyes see stars up above. So sweet, didn't take a lot of money just to make ends meet. With the love of a girl and a little bit of faith, there's a lot you can say for the old style way. In the old style way, life was so simple then, unlike today, in a world gone mad, where eyes warm and bright turn cold and gray. Still I can dream in the old style way. Still I can dream in the old style way.
That was Roby Kakalau, Brian Kessler, and Wade Cambern of the Hawaiian Style Band. They came on the show last March, celebrating the 25th anniversary of their debut album, Vanishing Treasures. Our Chris Vandercook had fun sitting down with them for a look back.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we say goodbye to 2017's best science stories. From the scientists' march on Washington to the Great American Eclipse.
I was just so amazed. It was just so amazing.
Plus your favorite stories of the year, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
We've been taking time to look back at the year, but now we're looking forward into the weekend as there are lots of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and colleague Dirk Malama joins us for a look at some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar.
Not at all, yes.
And we understand that Big Island residents will get a chance to meet the director of an award-winning film on Jane Goodall.
Yeah, this is happening tomorrow in Honoka'a. The documentary Jane will be screened for free in the Honoka'a People's Theater at 7 p.m. It won this year's Critics' Choice Award. The film uses previously unseen footage of Jane Goodall studying chimpanzees in Africa in the 1960s. And the writer and director, Brett Morgan, will be in Honoka'a to talk story following the film. This is happening tomorrow, once again, in the Honoka'a People's Theater.
It's a treat.
Yeah.
We also understand there's a classical concert. It's Manoa?
Yes. The winners of the Hawaii Music Teachers National Association competition will hold a recital in the Orvis Auditorium at 4 p.m. This is to help them pay traveling expenses for their next competition in Las Vegas happening next week.
And we understand folks on the Big Island can make mochi at Wailea Village tomorrow.
This is fun. Akiko's Bed and Breakfast hosts its 20th year of mochi pounding. There will be other activities as well, music and food for sale. This is happening from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Akiko's Bed and Breakfast is at 29-2091 Old Mamalohoa Highway on the Big Island.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jared.
Sure, you're welcome.
That's it for this week. From our family at The Conversation, we wish you and your family a safe and happy new year. We're preempted on January 1st, but we'll be back with you on Tuesday, the first show of 2018. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. And if you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's also where you can listen back to today's show. The program is produced by Lillian Zhang, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation. Oh, correct. Join us Tuesday and pick up the conversation.